Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast. My name is Josh Spicer, the owner and lead writer of Game Wisdom. My only guest tonight is artist for Smugby Games and Game Wisdom's site designer, Kenneth Ohm.
Hey there.
So, Ken, how has your week been going?
It's pretty much the sound I would make for my week. I have some pains in my arms recently, so I have to kind of just chillax. So I have to slow down and work and play and pretty much just sit and listen to audiobooks all day.
Well, at least you picked a week with all the big summer sales happening to be forced to play video games.
So pretty much, I just leave everything at idle and get cars that way. So there's a lot of ways to do what I want to do.
Yep, so this week we see a lot of big sales. GOG is running their big summer sale. And of course, by the time you listen to this podcast, the Steam summer sale has gone into full effect. And Ken, what has been going on with the Steam sale? Because I know that you've been following a little bit more than I have.
So a couple things that happened this week. One, TF2 got updated, a big update called Love and War, or something like that. And that coincides with, obviously, the Steam sales. Because right now, it's craziness in TF2, because they added a bunch of new stuff. But I'll talk about that a little bit later. For now, I'll talk about what's happening with the Steam sales. So they're adding a new meta to the Steam sales, where in the past, and if you guys have listened to previous casts, you know that I'm pretty obsessed with cards and Steam cards. And if you don't know what Steam cards are, they're little like items you get in your Steam inventory when you play games for a certain amount of time. And just like Pokemon, you can't collect them all yourself. You only get 4 cards in a set. And the only way to get half of the set. And the only way to get the rest of half the set is either by trading or by buying things from the marketplace. And you earn the cards not through just your play, but just your hours playing the game. So about 2 hours, 2 hours or more, you get all the cards you want from a game. And after that, you're tapped out and you can't get any more cards from that game. And the only thing you have now is a possibility of booster packs coming from that game. That's it. So randomly you'll get those. So when you actually collect a set, it gives you a couple of things. It gives you a background up in your profile. It gives you an emoticon, so you can just like cool little images on your chat profiles. Chat windows. And lastly, you get the badge for that. And obviously you can show your badge off if you want, but the big thing that I like to do is, you know, level up my profile. And it sounds really stupid to do that, but when you level up your profile, you get more boxes, more options, increased friends lists, stuff like that. And I think it's more of a vanity thing, but I like peering at the top of everyone's friends list. I'm like, mwah, 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 my profile is so beefy. But then there's people that have like 155, 160, 200 profile level. I'm like, how the hell did they do that? They must be spending like mad cash to be able to do that. Or like they stole accounts and took everyone's cards. Who knows?
Don't forget about the other way to get Steam cards, which is begging and pleading with your friends to give them to you.
It's trading. You're a miser. You trade nothing. Even with all the work, don't give me any cards. But there's a lot of ways to do it. So that's what people have done previously, and that's why a lot of people, you know, and it's also a good thing for everyone. I mean, obviously, Valve gets a lot of money from it, from all these microtransactions, but also the developers get a piece of the chunk of the cash that comes through when they sell cards and stuff that they own. And it also increases the sales of small indie games, too, because every game that has a card, people want to purchase and buy and obtain the cards. So, I mean, everyone's in the situation. And we actually have someone from the previous cast who regretted not putting cards in their games.
And you're referring to Keith Nevitz from Mouse Chief, correct?
Yeah. And it's not like no one could have factored that in and thought like, well, this is going to be the big thing. I should have get on the wagon. But, you know, now it's been proven and I think a lot of people are doing it. And now it's more of a common thing. So the new thing with Steam in the meta is that for this sale specifically for summer, whenever you craft a badge, you get a summer card, just like last year. And actually, I didn't even know this, but for the last week or two, when you were crafting cards, it gave you a mysterious card. And you're like, what the hell is a mysterious card? And you couldn't do anything with it. And then this morning, it actually appeared and said, oh, it's a summer card. Oh, it makes sense now. That's mysterious. Got it. But, you know, so now with this, you can assign yourself to a team, I guess. I didn't even know what team I assigned myself to. I just happened to be part of a team. And it places you in there. Then every time you craft a badge now, or craft, you know, your card set, you actually get a point for your team. And every time a team wins, the top 30 people that added like points to their team gets 3 games from their wish list, randomly chosen and bought for you. So actually, I went and bought all these and added a bunch of like expensive games and programs just in case. Mm-hmm. And I've been going through and taking care of all that. So looks like it's pretty cool stuff. And I guess you also get rewards for actually finishing your summer cards.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like foils and other cards. And I guess also when you purchase games over $10, you also get a card.
Mm.
So they're doing a lot of things like using this meta and this build up and all this card stuff and giving a lot more rewards just for using their system.
Yep. And I hope you made sure to add some sweet, sweet Railroad Simulator DLC to your wish list, because you could possibly get, you know, $2,000 of train DLC.
It's not like you do anything with that. It's lame. But I was going to say, though, before when we looked at games like systems like Gamerscape, where you buy games and you level up your profile and stuff, like I thought that was pretty neat. But I guess Steam was doing it on like steroids, if you think about it, because the profile has like leveling up systems. You now get perks for buying things now. You know, there's perks for getting cheaper games. Like sometimes you can buy a game on sale for $1 and the cards can sell over like 50 cents each. So you're making a profit buying those cheap games.
Unless you're me, then you'll sell for like 5 cents. That's my luck right there.
You keep missing out, man. Mm. All this awesome Steam, these market deals and stuff. Well, Lorsen just sold a Killstreak item for a new item for $150. Crazy. And she thought it was junk. She was going to like destroy it.
Ugh, I don't know what to say right now. I'm shocked and just very depressed after hearing that.
She also added $100 more for getting a golden item in TF2 for MVM. So, I mean, there's a lot of things. I think the marketplace for Steam is pretty robust, and I think they're doing not only they're helping indie developers, but they're getting the community more involved. And by putting money into it, it becomes everyone gets addicted to gambling.
Yeah, so, pretty much.
That's... Go Valve. So much better than Xbox Live and PSN.
And as you're saying, it's definitely interesting to see how they're adding this value to things that were just pretty much, you know, ancillary concepts. You know, like, remember when we first heard about achievements and they really didn't do anything other than a little blip on your profile? Now we got, you know, Steam cards, they had these badges, or you could just sell them. And there's this just insane economy that Steam has that no other digital distributor has.
Yeah, I mean, if you listen to Gabe's talk before where he wants Steam to go, he's talking about how he wants to give everyone not just obviously the main company to sell stuff, but allow everyone else to set up their mini stores. And in a way, we kind of doing that now, selling our cards and items, right?
Because
you can sell any item now on like TF2 or any other item from like Dota, and they sell for a lot of money. You can get some really good drops and sell for a lot of money. And instead of going through shady dealings with PayPal, you can sell it directly to the marketplace and get your money.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're already spending money on games, why not put it in your Steam wallet?
Yep. Now, I just wonder if we'll reach a point where we'll be allowed to actually sell our games on Steam. Because this has been one of like, the major points of contention among digital distribution.
I don't think that's ever going to happen. Mm-hmm. I don't think it would be. I think it would hurt the developers a lot. And there would be no real benefit, you know? You know what I mean? And it's also ease of use. I think they're circumventing that problem with the family system, you know? Mm-hmm. So if you can add someone to your family network and they can play your games, I think that's pretty fair. But doing the reselling thing, I don't think, because you're just selling like a key. I think it's a lot different than a feel of a used game, like a physical copy.
Yep, and that is still a major point that we're still arguing about, because in Europe, they did rule it legal that you should be able to sell your digital games to people, and that the developer is only entitled to the first sale of that copy.
Yeah, I think that it's going to be tricky for digital distribution services because of that kind of ruling. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't think the same rule should apply to a digital format than the physical format and the reselling of a game, because like, I guess like the price of the game is a bit superficial, right? Because people understand when physical media goes down, like when you see a game that's been out for a few months and it goes down to a certain percentage, when you actually see those kind of numbers come up, you understand. Over a digital distribution service, it's a little bit different because it's based on sales more like than depreciation of value. So I think it's, again, it's a different kind of a ball game, and I think it's a lot of stuff that the courts and the services have to kind of battle out.
Yep, definitely. We still haven't heard the end of it. And I think I feel that by the end of the decade, we should have more of an official ruling or an official guidelines on the matter. Because by then, I think digital distribution will be pretty much, seeded into all parts of our culture.
Oh, but I don't know. GameStop. Well, actually, I think GameStop is realizing that they were becoming the blockbuster of video games because it didn't make that announcement that they're going to stop selling game and start selling, like, tablets. I'm like, what the? Listen, if you, why don't you get into the game yourself, work with the Valve or work with any services or make your own? Or maybe make sort of coalition with you playing, EA's Origin, which sounds horrible. They could do that. If they all, like, merge together, they could actually combat Steam realistically.
Now, speaking about digital platforms, what do you think about the big GOG announcement? And that is that they are going to have their own digital platform coming soon. And what they're planning on doing with that is it'll still be completely no DRM. It's completely optional. You won't have to use it. But it will be a way of basically organizing your games, automatically updating them, and, chatting and communicating with your friends, much like on Steam.
I mean, more competition, the better, right? Because obviously having one load system, it's be nice. So, like, example, if my Steam were to go away one day, I at least have everything on my GOG still. I mean, that'd be horrible.
Yeah.
But it's, you're not putting your eggs all in one basket kind of thing. But at the same time, we don't know what their plans are exactly. Maybe they just want to add an ancillary part of the, of their company, and they want to create more of a sense of community in GOG, you know? Because people keep coming back to Steam because of the people, the social aspects of it, etc.
And don't forget about the easeability of it. I don't need to worry about, finding patches to other games. I don't need to worry about hunting down CD keys. It's pretty much I click a button, but, 20 minutes later, I have the game all downloaded and ready to go. There's no fuss and nothing about it.
That's my problem with GOG. It's because the system, there's too many steps, right? And even though I do have a library, I have to install it, then I have to find the folder, and I would like it to be a little more streamlined, like Steam is. That would be nice.
Yeah, man, I think that's why they are going the digital client route, because if they can do the same thing, say, okay, here's all your games, you don't need to hunt for that where you download the directory, 20 hours ago. Here it is, just click the button, it's yours, here's all the extras, have fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if they do that, they won't technically be, I mean, they're technically a direct competitor to Steam, but unlike Steam, I think they do a lot of work to get older games or forgotten games back into, viewership. They actually work with people for compatibility with newer computers, while Steam really isn't really famous for that,
Because
there's a lot more issues with that, and also the customer service for GOG, I heard, is a lot better than Steam's.
Yeah, GOG definitely has gotten as much goodwill, or maybe even more goodwill, out of its user base than Steam has. Because of what you said, they have great customer support, they have a lot of contests, a lot of interactions with their fans. Steam really, it still feels like this, mysterious entity in a sense. Like, you really don't get that, personable feeling out of Steam that you do with GOG.
You get, like, the Google thing,
Yeah.
It's Google, even though they do some great stuff, they're too big. There's no way you can contact a human in that company. Similar to, like, Steam, you really can't contact a human in that company. I mean, there's probably a way, but it's harder.
If you know a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy, then, yeah, you can get a hold of someone. But if you're just trying to make, like, a cold call to them, good luck. Maybe you'll get a response, or maybe your email goes into the filing bin somewhere.
Yeah, and you don't forget, like, that's why they're so famous to GOG, is their great service. And their willingness to hear all sides, and they usually do give refunds. There's not really a problem with that.
Yeah, they announced, this past year, the 30-day money back. So if any of the games you buy don't work, we'll give you your money right back. We were going to do regional pricing, but then after enough people made an outcry about it, they decided to rescind on that.
Yeah, and that's good. See, they're actually listening to requests and outcry and issues, while Steam is a little bit more monolithic. I mean, they're more nimble than, say, like those other giant corporations. But in comparison to GOG, they're slow.
Yeah, like, if people complain to Steam about something, you're not going to get any response. They may fix the issue, in a few months or a year, but you'll have no idea if they actually heard you or not.
Yeah, and if you really play devil's advocate, if Steam wanted to go, like, the EA route, and we were all under their thumb, we wouldn't have a choice as PC gamers, would we?
Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, Steam is the 900-pound gorilla at this point. I think we all agree on that.
But the only reason we allow it and we love it is because it hasn't done the EA and Ubisoft thing, right?
Yeah.
So, and again, the more competition, the better. And GOG does have a good reputation. And they could also turn, but hey, I mean, if both of them turn, that'd be even worse. But let's not think about worst-case scenario.
Yeah.
But go on.
I mean, just speaking about sales for a second, has Origin done anything this week or done any big summer sales, have you noticed?
I don't own Origin. You do.
But I don't play it.
You have to turn it on. Feel like,
but I don't want to.
Listen, they're gonna give you SimCity for free. You're gonna like it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna buy a copy and give it to Lorson when she gets back.
Perfect. She'll love that.
Yes, she will.
She has all that Steam money. She can go get SimCity.
Mm-hmm. But wait, SimCity's not on Steam. Well, I guess SimCity 4 is, but that's pretty much it.
It's way better than SimCity. We should when it goes down low enough, we should actually both play it and do our reviews separately on it.
Yeah. Okay, I guess going back to then the Steam and the just general sales then, it is definitely interesting just over like the last 4, maybe 5 years, how much this has grown and changed. And I guess this decade's big move then will probably be the whole rise of crowdfunding and early access. And I think this is one area that Steam has been sort of having trouble earning appeal from. There was the big announcement, I think, last week or the week before that Steam's official stance is basically buy at your own risk if you buy an early access game or greenlit game. So they're trying to, you know, on one hand, be the dominant force, but on the other hand, they're sort of saying, yeah, but we're not really going to do much if there's a problem.
Well, that's because they're becoming their third party. They're we give you direct connection to your developer, but it's a developer's issue to fix the problems. Because they can't police that many people. But at the same time, people yell at them for not greenlighting enough games or letting games actually come through the pipeline, right? Because listen to all the developers like that came later past, you know, the first couple waves of indies, right? They said that it's almost impossible to get their game actually on the marketplace.
Yep, and I've talked to a few developers like that, Soldak Entertainment, Cryptic Comet. These guys make really great games, but they've had nothing but bad luck getting onto Steam, which, as we've said before, when you get on Steam, you get, you know, the millions of users on that platform. And there are a lot of people who refuse to buy a game unless it is on Steam.
Right. And that's the thing. People have been complaining so much about, like, there's too many games coming out. I can't handle these games coming out. Mm-hmm. There's too many small developers. I'm like, listen, like, just like those guys, we should allow a system that's robust to allow these people to actually get on the marketplace and let the reviews and let, you know, their own marketing stuff, like, shine. And that way, you know, the cream rises to the top and the rest goes to the bottom. But we shouldn't put a big hammer on saying like this and this and this. But I'm not saying like let everything through. There's got to be some sort of filter. But saying that nothing should get through except for these big AA studios, that's silly. I think that would defeat the purpose of Steam.
Yeah, there definitely needs to be some kind of quality control, though. There is, of course, the recent stink about the game, I think it was Air Control on Steam, which just like looking at the videos and looking at the forums, it is just a major, you know, bad PR moment, just how horrible this game is and how it got on there. But then we've got, you know, other weird games that have made their niche, sort of like the Goat Simulator craze, which has astounded me with how many people are playing that.
Yes, huge. It has cards, too. I was thinking about getting it.
Maybe it will go on sale this week. Who knows?
Hopefully. I'm betting on it going on sale this week. Man, I've allocated a certain amount of money for Steam sales. There's a couple of games I'm looking for to go on sale. One of them is actually Watch Dogs. So did you hear the controversy with Watch Dogs? Just a little off topic.
I've heard some things about which controversy is this now.
So because of Watch Dogs being on the previous consoles and stuff, it's really ridiculous, right? And it's a bit conspiracy-like also that the reason the game doesn't look as good as when they released it in E3 is because they purposely took out a bunch of shaders and lighting stuff because they didn't want the PC to shine so far ahead of the console counterparts. But in actuality, a modder actually went into Watch Dogs and found all this code that was turned off. And they were all from the E3 presentation. So now the PC version has a patch from an unofficial patch by this modder, which turns on all this dynamic lighting and beautiful stuff and depth of field and stuff like that. It's really awesome stuff. It makes it look really, really good. It looks just as good as the E3 demonstration from the original teaser of Watch Dogs.
So it basically sounds like Ubisoft screwed themselves again.
Again, but this one's a complete dick move. They're like, we don't want this game to look way better than our console counterparts. So we want to cripple it as much as possible. But why?
Yeah, it
Why
makes.
would you?
Because I don't think they make a lot of good decisions. I think that's the simple point.
Well, remember their original stance on PC games is we don't want to make things on PC because people pirate it all the time,
That,
right?
yeah, that's another stupid thing. And then they had all the crazy, Uplay crap that, oh, if your internet drops out for a second, you can't play your single player game. And that pretty much killed it for like the first year. It probably also ruined the chance of us seeing another The Settlers game, because that came out right as Uplay was first announced.
So I guess the question is, why do you listen? If you hate PC so much, Ubisoft, why even release on the PC?
So you still want your money. That's pretty much it.
I mean, it's true, but like, if they're putting all this stuff into defense and anti-piracy, and obviously they want to lower the quality of games to make it equivalent to like an aging, like 6-year-old console, or actually, it's older than that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's gotta be
9 years? No.
maybe like 7 or 8. It's been That's the thing about
Eight
Assassin's Creed.
years.
It's so someone just so hard to remember when major things happen because they're moving so quick.
2005, probably. So 9 years. Let's go with 9 years.
Now, about a modder fixing a game, it does remind me a bit about Dark Souls 1 and what was the DS fix. This was when a modder basically went in and he basically fixed the cap on the frame rate, crashing, resolution support, and pretty much became a standard requirement for Dark Souls on the PC. Even Steam has it on the page saying, hey, if you're going to play Dark Souls, make sure to download this mod. I think part of that was because the developers didn't know how to really work on the PC platform, because FromSoftware is usually just a console developer. So this was a case where the modder was able to make the game better and fix what the developers couldn't. But with what you're saying with Watch Dogs, it's more like the modder is going around the crap that Uplay or Ubisoft did, and it's basically giving us what we were supposed to get in the first place.
Yeah, they even have little like, notes and stuff within the code saying, "Oh, this is just for PC, who cares?" Like kind of things like that.
Like this is PC, don't put it in or something like that.
Yeah, things like that saying don't act, don't turn on, blah blah blah. So it's really silly looking at all the stuff that they could have had. Even some ambient occlusion stuff, some really nice shadow stuff. I'm like, "Wow. Why take that all off? Why make it look so crappy? What was the point? Why like looking at the screenshots now?" Before and after, it's like night and day, literally night and day, about the quality between the two.
My hunch is that they want you to buy the console versions because there's probably a higher premium for those copies. Because not only do you buy the game, you also have to have the subscription service. It's a lot more regulated, so you don't have to worry too much about sales. So I think they're just trying to get a bigger piece of the pie by screwing out the PC audience.
Yeah, I mean, you had to look at the games like that's why also I'm very excited for GTA 5 coming on the PC because looking at that trailer and the draw distances, I'm like, oh, drool, it looks so good.
I just hope they won't force us to install the Rockstar social platform or whatever the hell it is.
I'm just waiting to be modded. What I want to do, maybe same thing with Watch Dogs, is make a first person mod for the game, then have an Oculus Rift and walk around like a city, but not kill anybody, just walk around. Be like, a city.
Speaking about Ubisoft as another completely random tangent, I finally got to play South Park: The Stick of Truth last week. I ran
Yes.
it, and it was okay, but it definitely felt like it was a South Park game first, RPG maybe third or fourth. Like it was so easy to break the RPG systems of the game, but the story was, South Park insanity at its finest.
Yes, that's what I've heard. So, I mean, honestly, to the franchise, it actually did its service, which is cool. Most times it doesn't. If you look at the old games, like Love Shack and all that stuff, it's terrible. So this is probably the first good South Park game. Unless you count the South Park N64 one, which was so awful to look at now.
And I would say with that, I don't see, unfortunately, I don't see South Park being worth $60. I mean, I beat the game in a 3-day rental, and I spent, $4 on it at that point.
There's a few games I would say it was $60 out. Like I would say GTA 5 is probably worth $60. Like all the content placed into it, all the work, all the licensing, everything like that. That's a labor of love, that game. That's not like one of those games that are just regurgitated every year.
The Call
So,
of Duties, the Maddens.
those aren't worth $60. Like if again, if like a new Sky, a new version of Elder Scrolls or a new version of Fallout came, that's worth $60 for sure. There's definitely, we should actually make a list of what $60 worth to you. Like, what's a game that's worth $60, you would say? What franchise? Or new IP that you're looking forward to?
I would say pretty much Nintendo still has their higher premium. Other than that, really, there's just not a lot of games that I would spend $60 on, because I'm still going through my backlog of $4 or $5 games. But I think I'm pretty much in the minority on this, because I buy so many games and I get them from, you know, Game Wisdom, you know, being quote-unquote press now. So I have all these games in my backlog, so I don't need to spend, you know, first day. Pretty much Atlus may be close, but their games are usually in the $40 to $50 range when they first come out.
Right, which is why when unless Dragon Age 3 comes out with some amazing hats, I'm not buying that one day one. And plus, if I get Dragon Age 3, I'm going to have to download Origin. It's got to be, the reviews have to be freaking glowing. Like, they need, not just, I'm becoming a scientist here. I'm going through every review, every indie review, personal friends reviews, stitching it together. Then I'll actually maybe purchase the game at the full price. But if it even gets a mediocre score, I am waiting like 2 years before I buy that game.
Well, you look at the planetary alignment during that time. You could also use tarot cards.
All those things.
Bones, like, you could roll.
A little eight ball.
A fortune teller.
Yes, I have to make sure I'm ready, because the Dragon Age 2 has hurt me so bad. It's an abuse. It's like, it's scars. It's still scarring to this day. Remember Dragon Age 2.
Yeah. At least you were able to get over Final Fantasy 14 after they re-release it. So,
well, I forgive them, because they fixed it. It's still in history as the worst launch ever, but they still try to fix it. Dragon Age 2, there was no apologies for that game.
That was just, you know, here it is, you know, bye. You know, hey, look over there, and run away.
For me, Dragon Age 2 is, I was thinking about it, it's very similar to the prequels for Star Wars, the first one. Because you're watching it, because like when people watch the first movie, they're like, hey, this was good, right? And then they try to watch it again, like, come on, I'm watching it again. It's good, right? It's got to be good. Star Wars, it's got to be good. And then the third time, they're like, no, this isn't good. This isn't Star Wars. And this is the same thing with Dragon Age 2. I'm like, I play it, I try to start it up again, try to play it, and I'm like, no, this isn't Dragon Age. I can't. I'm supposed to like this.
Speaking about games that people seem to like for some reason, I was trying to get into the Lego games. There was a few of them on sale the other week. I tried playing Lego Batman, Lego Lord of the Rings, and they were just so simplistic. Like, there was no sense that this was designed for multiple audiences. It felt like it was a game meant just for, like, the 4 to 8 year old category. But even then, it's so simplistic. I just don't understand how it's gotten such a big following among older gamers.
I don't know. They do interesting IPs. It's a pretty simple game. I have a friend who's actually pretty obsessed with this game. So he was like selling it to me, like, gotta do this, gotta do that, gotta try this, don't get this one. I'm like, yeah, trying to be nice, but in the end, I don't want to play any of those games. And I'm actually surprised you even bought those games.
It was on sale for like $3. That was pretty much my limit.
It's too much. Too much.
Okay. Right. So I think with that, let's move on and talk a little bit about some games we've been playing. Unless, do you have any final things you want to say about the whole sales and Steam going on?
Good luck, everyone. Don't forget to update your wish list. You never know when you might get one of your, like, not only can one of your games go on sale and Steam will alert you, but Steam might also, by randomness, choose one of your games to give to you.
And make sure at all, if you really want to go crazy, you should make them try to buy, like, the train simulator, the farm simulator. You know,
expensive stuff.
Exactly. There you go. You won't be able to sell any of it, but you can, you know, be the envy among your friends, saying, look, I have all the Train Simulator DLC.
I throw all the $60 games out there. Just put them on there. Go for it.
All right. So let's talk about some of the games we've been playing. And the one that I've just started was Transistor. So, of course, for those of you who don't know, Transistor is the second game from Supergiant Games. These are the developers behind the amazing game Bastion that I think came out in 2011 or 2012. Do you remember?
I think it was 12.
And I've been playing it on and off, and I'm just finding that it's not hooking me as much as Bastion was. And I think part of the problem is the combat. The system they're trying to do, pretty much, like, it's turn-based, but you also have a real-time element to it. And how it works is you can either play the game real-time, and you can use your attacks whenever you want, there's no cooldown, or you go turn-based, and you queue up all your attacks in a turn, then they all happen pretty much instantaneously, and then you have to wait like 4 or 5 seconds for the meter to refill. And it sounds great in theory, but the problem is that the game really punishes you for not using the turn-based mode. And the reason is that enemies can attack you very quickly, they can track you almost instantaneously, and you have no real defensive options other than your abilities. So you're kind of left in this state of, if I go real-time, I'm just going to get hit by 10 guys and I can't dodge them. But then if I go turn-based, then, you know, I spend 5-6 seconds at a time doing nothing but run around. It reminds me a lot of the Breath of Fire system from way back in, I think that was 2002, 2003, Breath of Fire Dragon Quarter. And what they did to get around that was, if you don't use all your meter or all your action points in a turn, it gets pulled into your next turn. And you can do that, I think, up to 2 or 3 times, and then you can unleash one, you know, super turn of, you know, 12 attacks or whatever. Now, I will say that the one element that I really did enjoy from Transistor's system is the fact that all your abilities, or what they're called functions, have at least 3 different purposes. You can either equip them as an attack, you can attach them to another function, then they act as a passive ability, or you attach them to yourself, and they give you a unique perk. And it's very well designed how you can synergize these functions between attack, passive, and perk. And I would like to have seen this in a more open-ended, or it's not as linear experience as Transistor was. And have you heard about the punishment system in the game yet, Ken?
What is it?
Essentially, if you die or your health hits zero during combat, you revive, but one of your active functions gets disabled until you reach a predetermined amount of waypoints or way stations. They're essentially the save points in the game. So what ends up happening is, if you die, you're effectively punished until you reach that arbitrary point. Now, when you start having the functions, it then becomes interesting because then you can start experimenting with other functions. But it just seems like a very, I'm not sure how to describe it, like weird punishment for a linear game. If this was, you know, an open world where you can travel to different points and go back and forth, I don't think it would be as damning. But because you're playing a linear game with these force encounters at these set points, it kind of feels like it's very easy to screw yourself or make subsequent battles not as engaging because of it.
Well, you think about it the other way, that it also makes it more interesting because you're not reliant on the abilities that you're used to, and you're going to have to experiment. In this way, like a lot of games, instead of just focusing on one combo, you have to rely on others.
Yeah.
So even though it is pretty damaging and can be annoying, but at the same time, it might give you enjoyment you wouldn't have had if you haven't tried that combination.
And I will say one really great touch, and this definitely shows a great eye to detail among designers, is the fact that all the functions have pretty much the same basic attack strength. They may do, you know, this one may be a spread shot, this may be a grenade, but they keep to a set list of damage values. And what that means is that there's no one function that does more damage than anything else. So that, as you said, Ken, that makes it so that you don't have to rely on, I have to use this function with this perk and this passive at all times, or I'm not doing as well. It lets you experiment and be creative with the system, and I think that really does elevate Transistor. Now, I haven't finished the game yet, so I don't know if my impressions will change once we get to the end.
Actually, I heard that the end is the least, or the least exciting part of the game, or it's kind of where they drop the ball.
Okay, so it'll be interesting to see that. And of course, if I'm talking about Transistor, I have to mention the art style and the music. They're both exceptionally well done.
About the music, about the soundtrack, before about the game.
And it's a great touch. There's a button that you can press that she'll hum the music or whatever the ambient noise is in the level in that current environment. She'll hum it just by you holding down a button. And the music just sounds really great. The art style, it looks similar to Bastion, but it looks a lot sharper and more detailed than Bastion was.
And I really think that Art Nouveau look is beautiful in it.
Definitely a strong case for, you know, maybe most visually pleasing or strongest art aesthetic in a game for 2014.
Yeah, and as an artist, thinking about where the person brought their influences from, like, that's an influence that that's an age of time, like, between the 20s and 40s, that I really love about America, because it definitely had a certain style, certain look. And if you look at us now, like, in the 2000s, I feel like we're kind of devoid of that. I feel like our art style is commercial, and that's not really a style that I would kind of want to, you know,
and that's
attach myself to.
That's why I hear a lot of car guys say about, you know, how car design has changed from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and today. Today, a lot of cars look very much utilitarian. They're all meant to be mass commercialized. There's no real style to them. And then when you look at, you know, cars from like the 50s and 60s, they have that certain sense of elegance, that style to them that you don't see anymore these days.
Yeah, and there's companies out there that are releasing awesome versions of both, you know, efficient, productive and powerful cars like the Tesla cars look amazing. If that takes off and they actually lower the price to a reasonable level, I would buy one immediately.
Yep, and there's like that debate among restoration people that do you restore a 40s car, you know, exactly how it would be back then, or do you modernize the car so that it may look like something from 1940, but it may handle like someone from today, or may have, you know, features like, you know, anti-lock brakes and stuff like that.
Well, I think I would go with the second one just because you get the style. That's what you want. You want the style. That's what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But you have the modern parts, which makes it safe, reliable, efficient, right?
Yeah.
So that makes sense to me.
And about that sort of 1930s 40 art style, is that also why you enjoyed the art style from Skullgirls?
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. Like that, anything that's noir or that age or the 20s, 30s, 40s, even the 50s, especially what I love is like, as an artist too, is the version of the future that the 50s saw.
Sort of like the Art Deco style?
Art Deco, the bubbles, you know, the round corners, everything being like, think of those silly robot designs back in the 50s, like all that kind of stuff. I really enjoy it because to me that was pretty imaginative, but it also has a look, something that's distinctive. And, you know, the robots we have now aren't really, except for that Honda robot, the Mizo, what's his name?
I don't know.
That one actually looks kind of like a 50s robot to me. But right now everything is obviously about efficiency, and I feel like kind of like the creative parts of a lot of things that a lot of products that are coming out are really, the only creative ones that look really interesting are the ones from like the crazy billionaires or like the crazy millionaires. But the rest is obviously, they always cut it for maximum profit. So like the style and the soul of it is kind of drained out for like cost efficiency. I think that's a major problem with now, because everyone's always about tightening their belt and worrying about the economy. Or because I'm sure you hear that all the time. Like everyone always like, bad economy, tighten the belt. I'm like, ugh. where'd the love and style go?
And we hear the same thing about, you know, the AAA developers and how they have become so risk adverse that every game we see AAA will usually start, you know, straight white male fighting other straight white males, first person shooter, online multiplayer. And where are like the unique games coming from is the indie market, where they have that freedom to self-express what they want in design, as opposed to meeting, you know, the shareholders' demands, and it has to sell 3-4 million copies or the series dies, stuff like that.
That's across the board if you think about it, because movies are the same problem. These summer movies, like there's a major problem with, okay, so to me, the mega franchises of comic movies is an issue. Marvel's doing a really good job right now.
Yeah.
All their movies are doing really well. They've had a great plan. Avengers did great. The secondary movies coming out, the, you know, after the Avengers, post-Avenger movies are doing really well. But then we have companies like Sony, which released Amazing Spider-Man 2, which was awful, awful, terrible. And the only reason they made the movie was because they're losing their rights for it. And though X-Men's doing a good job, they all want to do the same thing. And DC, too, they all want to do something Marvel's doing. So what's going to happen? You have all these companies releasing really shoddy products, they're shoddy because they're trying to play it really, really safe, because it costs so much money to make these blockbuster movies, like hundreds of millions, right?
Yep, and they don't have the trust in the brand, the product, that they would make something unique that would sell as well.
Right. Well, Marvel has, a great properties. They have a lot of people looking at it. They know how precious these series are. Well, these people are like, oh God, we got to catch up, and because they're kind of catch up, they cut a lot of corners and they play it way, way, way too safe. And there's a lot of meddling, because Spider-Man 2 is the definitive like studio film. Like directors have certain looks, like The Man of Steel, even though people didn't like it, Zack Snyder had a certain look to his films. Nolan has a certain look to his films. But Amazing Spider-Man 2 has no look. It's kind of similar to the AAA games that we see now, like how Fuse came out. Like that was like, to me, like the probably publisher meddling, or like whoever was funding them meddling, making it so safe, or like those games
homogenized,
like,
basically.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a problem not for just, you know, games, but movies or any other like big releases. It's just people are playing it just so safe mm-hmm. because they can't take that risk because the development costs have become so high.
Yep, and we're seeing just a lot of movies just falling back on the same genres and tropes that it's just annoying as hell to see a lot of movies just come out. It's like the same thing we've seen before. There's so many remakes and reissues going on. I'm betting they're going to do another thing with Twilight at some point, which I'm, you know, all excited about there.
Of course you're excited about that one.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was saying before about the mega, like, franchise movies,
mm-hmm.
eventually too many are going to come up and they're going to collapse. No matter how good those Marvel films are going to be, no matter how good
mm-hmm.
Marvel's doing it, because everyone else is doing an awful job, there'll be too many movies coming out, too much fatigue, and they'll collapse. Similar to the World War II shooter age of 2000s for games. And eventually our modern day war shooter will eventually collapse. And I think it's collapsing right now if you think about it.
Yeah, who else is out there other than Call of Duty and Battlefield? It's so we're down to just those last two remaining properties.
Bad Company, there was also Medal of Honor. There was a SOCOM game that came out. Like, all these games that try to be like a modern war shooter, like mm-hmm. it's just there and dying. I mean, the Vegas game's coming out? Not Vegas, I mean Tom Clancy.
Yeah, Rainbow Six.
Rainbow Six is coming out. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't look that
mm-hmm.
interesting.
Yeah. Speaking about cutting corners at DC, I'm still really surprised we haven't seen, like, a Wonder Woman movie come out. Because from the DC, it's pretty much Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman are the big three. And, you know, they're talking about how, oh, it's so hard to make a leading female character in a movie. We don't know how it's going to work. And then we keep hearing Marvel, you know, the Guardians of the Galaxy, they have, you know, characters like a talking raccoon, Dream Man. So it's, as you said, Marvel has done a lot of their homework. They know how to treat these characters with respect, and they are being rewarded from it. But as you're saying, I think you may be right. We may be reaching that point of saturation among these big superhero movies.
But you know what the thing with Marvel is? They respect their directors. They respect mm-hmm. their artists. They know what they leave it in their hands. They pick the right people and they say, you bring your people, you do the job, we fund you. That's it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Good work. And they obviously give them the wealth of knowledge they need too, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the other guy's just metal. Like Spider-Man 3 wouldn't have been so awful if the studio didn't come in like, we need Venom. Kids love Venom. We're going to make toys for it.
Mm-hmm. And that's how, speaking about toys, that's how the Cartoon Network DC series got cut, because the toys weren't selling. Even though people were watching the shows, because they weren't selling enough toys or wasn't meant for toys, you know, they decided to cancel those series.
Yeah, but you have to know one thing, mm-hmm. is even though Marvel does great with their mm-hmm. their live-action stuff,
mm-hmm.
DC does a really good job in their animated films
exactly.
and their TV series.
Mm-hmm.
Like Arrow, Gotham, like Smallville.
Yeah.
Flash is coming out.
And Marvel, they have been just putting out crap after crap among their animated series. Ultimate Spider-Man, Avengers Assemble, the Hulk cartoon. And there was a time where there were some really great Marvel animated series. Probably the only one I can think of is the Spectacular Spider-Man that came out a few years ago.
See, I wouldn't say they're crappy. I think they're very average. Averagey good. But they're not DC level of awesome quality.
And don't forget about the DC movies as well, the animated movies they've done that, which have also sold
or
really well.
Son of Batman, because think about their background. Warner Brothers in animation. They know how to do it, right?
And they have, of course, you know, Bruce Timm, which a lot of fans have dubbed, you know, the Timmiverse, because he's mm-hmm. just such a great director. He, of course, was the man behind Batman the Animated Series, which was, mm-hmm. which probably still is the standard for making, you know, not exactly adult, but, you know, older audience animated series.
Yeah, GLA, Justice League Unlimited, all that stuff. It's amazing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So again, they have, like, to me, instead of, like, going for the movie market entirely, they should just keep, they're already ahead in the animated and television department. They should push forward in that direction instead of trying to chase the dream that Marvel's already accomplished. I mean, they should still compete, but not, like, try to do the mega franchise. Because the reason why Amazing Spider-Man 2 was so awful is because they added, like, four villains, right? And the reason they did it is to set up for a Sinister Six movie and a Venom movie and a bunch of other movies, because the only thing Sony has is Spider-Man. That's it. That's all they got.
Well, that's right. Fox has X-Men, which and Fantastic Four, which they're going to be rebooting.
Well, there's also a chance that they might not make the Fantastic Four and it might go back to Marvel. That's also a rumor. That'd be great, by the way.
And as an interesting aside about that, I was watching a special that ABC was doing about Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and how that the whole Marvel Universe got started. When it first started, when they were doing Iron Man, they were picking the heroes, there was that great concern that, you know, who would want to watch an Iron Man movie or a Thor movie or a Hulk? Because everyone knew Marvel as being X-Men and Spider-Man Fantastic Four at the time. And so it kind of worked to Marvel's favor that they were able to do whatever they wanted with these B-list heroes. And now these characters are probably bigger than Spider-Man and X-Men among the general audience.
Yeah, they're definitely bigger than Spider-Man. He's been doing awful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's made the most money, but he's also done the worst, like, critic-wise.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the X-Men reboot's doing a pretty good job, and it looks pretty great. And I think that if anyone makes a franchise, Fox can do it with X-Men, because X-Men, mutant, they have all mutants. That's a huge amount of characters they can mm-hmm. use. It's all of them. But I would love to see X-Men go back to Marvel.
Yeah, I know. I saw an interview, I think, Hugh Jackman gave that he would love to be in the Avengers. And I kind of admit, it would be awesome to see, you know, Hugh Jackman alongside, you know, Robert Downey Jr. and everyone just interacting in the Avengers series.
Because in the comics, they actually do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's great. I love how we're talking about this. But it's something that is relevant, too, because big blockbusters and movies are similar to big blockbuster games.
Mm-hmm.
Blah.
It's your turn to mess up, yes.
Blah. But anyways, it's very interesting to see how all these blooming costs make some, like, studios, like, falter and cripple and some, like, soar higher and higher.
Yeah. And with TV, I was listening to an interview that Kevin Spacey gave, and he feels that this is becoming, like, the golden age of television, because a lot of these famous actors and big names are moving to television where they have the freedom to make the stories they want, and we're seeing a lot of high-quality programming where we would used to see that among the big blockbusters or the movies. So stuff like Breaking Bad, Fargo, which I love, that just wrapped up the season this week. I started watching Penny Dreadful on Showtime, which is okay. But these are series that are, they have very high production values, they get big name stars, and they're aiming for a higher quality of programming compared to, you know, what we see on like CBS and the NBC, you know, Tuesday night lineup and stuff like that.
Well, you think about this too. When you have that many episodes, you spend a lot more time with the characters, so development isn't as rushed, right? And I'm always surprised. I mean, movies cost so much money, but there's only a limited amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
But with a TV show, you can spread it out and give these characters room to breathe. And that's sort of what they did with Arrow on the CW, which I'm still surprised it turned out even half as good as it did, you know, given the CW's penchant for, you know, trying to keep with teen drama as their MO.
Well, I probably because the directors did a pretty good job trusting those guys, and they're actually going to make my favorite superhero,
The Flash.
The Flash, right?
Yeah.
Right. So I'm very excited to see that, and I want to see what they're going to do with that property.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's a question really back to games: is what studio has better games attached to their licenses?
That is a tough one. There's just so many studios to pick from. I would probably say the worst ones would probably be, you know, EA. I would say probably good licenses would probably be Blizzard at the moment. They really know how to treat their games as brands. Another really good example, which we'll probably talk about in a few minutes, would be Valve with Team Fortress. Team Fortress to me is just, I have no idea how it all came together, but it's such an amazing combination of brand, design, and aesthetic to make this very unique property.
And don't forget, there's a lot of meta tied to it of why it's loved. But I actually meant what good IP, what Marvel and DC properties, what has done well in the gaming industry?
I know the Spider-Man games have been hit or miss.
Miss.
Yeah, there have been like maybe two hits. I think Spider-Man 2, the movie game, and the Shattered Dimensions game that came out.
Really? I actually like the Ultimate Spider-Man, the cel-shaded one. That's my one. I got that for the PC. I loved it.
I thought it was just okay. I was more used to the realistic swinging from Spider-Man 2, which, as a great coincidence, that's what Jamie, I think, Freestorm, the guy who went to do Energy Hulk, and is now working on that.
That's how he got, like, that pull was enough for his Kickstarter. It was all like, hey, guys, I made that awesome system for Spider-Man 2. Everyone loved, like, we love that guy. Let's go for him.
Yeah, like, here's the money. Just throw it at him.
Yeah, it was awesome. We interviewed him, too. He was a really cool guy. Go ahead.
I also heard there was the Deadpool game, which actually sucked. I think they actually took it off of Steam.
Wow. Took it off of Steam? What?
Mm-hmm.
I never heard of such a thing. But I heard that the Amazing Spider-Man 2 was even worse than the movie, or just as bad as the movie. And they made it so, like, when you swing, you need to actually make a prompt every time you swing.
I was watching, I think, a Let's Play on that. It just looked horrible to play.
It looked like a PS2 game, actually, the quality of art.
And speaking about DC with their strange, hit and miss with how their properties are, probably the best licensed game would arguably be the Batman series. Arkham Asylum, Arkham City. We don't talk about
Yeah.
Arkham Origins.
I mean, Arkham Origins wasn't bad. It was just
Yeah.
average.
And
It's like BioShock 2.
yeah, but even an average Batman game was still one of the better games of that year.
Definitely. I think, yeah, this probably has the best part. I mean, I guess you could say Injustice, right? Is pretty good.
Yep, and as you were saying earlier, I think DC does give their writers a little bit more leeway with how they approach these characters and how they develop them, and then we get great stuff like Injustice, Green Lantern, the animated series. I actually like Beware the Batman that was on Cartoon Network for a little bit of time. So they do give them that freedom, and I think with Marvel, they're so wrapped up in this, brand, this meta connection, that everything has to be connected in some way to each other. So they can't make a show just about Spider-Man doing stuff completely unrelated, because that would, affect what they're doing in the movie.
Well, it is kind of weird because there's so many questions in those films of what the hell is mutants doing? Where are the mutants, right? And they showed Quicksilver and Wanda Witch at the end of one of the movies, and I'm not gonna say which one, but they called them like special. They didn't call them mutants. They're not mutants.
Yeah, they legally can't use the term
Call they're
mutant.
mutants. That's stupid. Marvel owns it. Like they can do it all they want in the comics because they didn't sell that out. They were smart enough not to sell those rights away. But they sold so many rights away. What a mistake.
Now that I think that was during the time that Marvel was actually going to be going bankrupt. So they were
Bankrupt.
see how crazy it is sometimes? At one point they're going bankrupt and now they're one of the most premier comic and movie developers in the world.
Billions.
Yeah.
Billions.
And as one quick aside then for me about DC, I think another problem you said is that a lot of directors don't seem to love the IP or love the work they're doing. There's that whole sting where the director was calling out the Incredible Hulk or She-Hulk, saying that she was just made to be the romance of the Incredible Hulk.
What the hell?
And
Who
then,
said that? I forget that guy's name. He was drunk, I heard.
he was giving an actual press conference though, which is really great. And then he called anyone who knew who Martian Manhunter was a nerd, which is
Yeah.
really great. That's the kind of guy you want.
I know this guy. I mean, someone had a podcast about this guy too, and the thing is that She-Hulk is like a cousin of the Hulk. It
Yeah.
was never supposed to be a love interest. Two, she's an amazing character. People love her because she can change back to human, but she chooses to be green because she's not, she's proud of what she is. Two, she's an attorney and a lawyer, so she's not like a superhero full time. She's actually first an attorney, and she actually represents a lot of funny trials of superheroes and villains and stuff. So it's pretty cool.
And
And the,
so, like, the
yeah, go ahead.
director was just insulting not only Marvel, but he was insulting his own license. And he's supposed to be, I think, working on one of the DC movies.
Yeah, it's just pure ignorance on those all that stuff. Like, why? See, if you don't want to work in comic book movies, then just go make another movie. Who cares? You can find it if you can land a DC film, then land another film. Who cares? If you don't like it, then like you're gonna do the movie a disservice if you hate the property you're working on.
And that's why I think a lot of people are saying what happened with like Man of Steel and how it turned out to be completely wrong for Superman. Like they basically wanted to make another Batman Begins, essentially.
They made him gritty. He allowed him to kill. He's not allowed to kill. And he also killed a lot of people in that city.
And that's not how the Superman is supposed to generally be. Like, when you have these characters, I mean, yes, you can take some liberties with the characters, but when you change their core values, then it's not the same character.
Exactly. And I think Captain America is one of those franchises that really turned it around because everyone thought, oh, Captain America, Boy Scout, boring. But he's not boring. He's just a good guy. And you see that he's not only a man out of time, but he's a man looking for what's the right thing to do. And in the Captain America, Winter Soldier is an amazing film because this is more than just a film about like, oh, being really cool and being powerful. It's a film with a message. And it's a message that's very analogous to the American people and like kind of like what the corrupting force is in that movie is very similar to the NSA in our current, society. So it's really great talking about like privacy, security, freedom, like liberty and rights. And I think that's amazing that a film, especially a comic book film, can talk about some serious points like that, be made to be more like an actual political thriller than a comic book movie, which is amazing.
And that was sort of how they were approaching the first Captain America movie. They didn't make it saying this is a Captain America movie. They said they want to make it more like an old time war movie, like have that excitement, that spy, the espionage type feel to it.
I think that's very smart because they're making movies within a genre instead of making a comic movie first and then a genre after. And I think that's a problem with a lot of these other films, like Sony's. Sony is probably the worst offender of the worst movies of the superhero genre. Like, did they own Daredevil too? Did
I
they make
think
that?
they. I'm actually not sure. I thought Fox made that, but I'm not 100% sure.
Well, those movies all suffer from the same. It's a comic movie first and a genre thing later. I'm like, listen, like treat them. Like, and I think that DC also does, you're right about the Man of Steel thing, making it Nolan. Not everything works with Nolan, right? Maybe if you made like the Punisher Nolan, that would make plenty of sense. Like certain characters that are gritty like that, real characters, could easily be nullified, but not anything else. But I still love the Batman. I think they did a great job.
Yeah, Batman was pretty good. I kind of felt the third one started to get a little old at that point. It
I
kind
haven't watched the third one,
of.
but all I know is the second one was amazing. And I know that Captain America, Winter Soldier, was also amazing. If you haven't seen it, definitely watch it.
Yeah, I still need to see that one. I did just see Thor 2, and
Nah.
I, of
More,
course,
but
saw the Avengers.
that was more like entertainment, Thor 2. But Captain America is the real deal. Like, that one's probably the best of the post-Avenger films right now.
Yep, and it's kind of crazy how Marvel is not being risk adverse compared to the other movie makers. As we talk about Guardians of the Galaxy's coming, I mean, I heard they have their whole like timeline mapped up for like the next 15, maybe like 10, 15 years of what they're going to do like movie wise. You know, if this happens, we're going to make this movie, and they have it separated into all these phases. I mean, Marvel really is like synonymous with like Valve, and they make these plans. They evolve things out as a, thoughtful plan, as opposed to just throwing things against the wall and seeing what sticks.
Right, that what Sony does. So, but like, if this is successful, if Guardians of the Galaxy is successful, they have the whole Marvel Galaxy universe to experiment with, which is amazing. So many characters, right? But like, I'm excited for that movie the most because I feel like just like Winter Soldier and stuff, they're gonna make it not a superhero film, but a sci-fi, like a real legit sci-fi opera film. Like a lot of these other films, like Edge of Tomorrow and Oblivion, are just like sci-fi action. But what I want to see with Guardians of the Galaxy is sci-fi legit with some action in it, but mostly just sci-fi universe. So I'm excited for Guardians of the Galaxy. That's like my top movie for the summer.
And as we're saying, they have this whole plan. So if, let's say by some strange coincidence that Guardians of the Galaxy doesn't do well, they still have a plan for that, and they have a plan for this, and they're even having stuff for, the Doctor Strange movie, which will be, I think, the first time that Marvel had like magic elements and like more of like a supernatural bent to it.
Right, that's gonna be weird. That's also weird in the DC universe. You know, Superman weakness, one of his weaknesses is magic. Weird.
All right, so I think this may be the record for the longest tangent we've had on the
Yeah,
cast
but
so
this is a
far.
huge tangent onto movies, but
But it does sort of relate to video games, at least in the AAA kind of homogenization that's been going on.
right. I mean, right now what's going on is we see so many high budget games with crazy release schedules, like going far into many years, past like so many games in 2015 over, this year. And don't forget that, this is the rising cost of all this tech and stuff like that. And like things are definitely changing because, yeah, consoles are there and consoles are selling, but the PC market is getting stronger and getting better.
Yep, and it will be very interesting to see just what happens when the Steam box actually comes out, and if it will affect the console market at all.
You know what I'm excited for? Virtual reality. Next month. Next month. I just have to survive till next month, and I can get my Devil Rose Kit too. So as long as I don't die, I can experience virtual reality at a higher fidelity.
Cool.
I'll take pictures of it. I'll make a first impressions for the site, and
Cool.
I'll actually post pictures of a rotating Oculus Rift.
Nice. All right. So let's move on then after all that. And I know the, as we mentioned earlier, the big update from Valve would be the Team Fortress update that not only adds new stuff, but change some things around. So Ken, what exactly has been going on with Team Fortress?
Well, first, the update's called Love and War, I believe. And they released a 15-minute TF2 movie, which is amazing,
Yeah, I
giving
love
lots of
that.
hints and tours. You watched it? Yeah, like that's what I want. Like someone said, Pixar for adults, definitely. I would if someone would kickstart that or like fund that to make a, like a series out of it, like a web series. I would throw all my money at it. I want it. I want it. I want to see it because that's an amazing writing, amazing animation. They did a lot of work for that. So what they did with this update was, first of all, I kind of explained TF2. So TF2 first started as, a artistic game. It's based on a mod that was originally made for Quake, and then they actually ported it to Source, and then it became part of Orange Box. It's a bunch of classes with different abilities fighting the same class with different abilities on the various maps. And I like how I'll simplify TF2 to be that like that, but it's how old? Almost 10 years old, that game. And after 10 years, that game is still going and making a ton of money, still, even now, making a ton of money. Because eventually they experimented with it by adding hats. And it sounds really stupid. Everyone's always laughing about how silly hats are, but hats make a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
And they also added a crafting system so you can make like specialized weapons, which get added after every update, along with new versions of hats. And eventually, they opened something called the Marketplace, which allows you to sell items, sell hats, sell miscellaneous stuff, along with trading services and stuff like that. The third-party sites that do all that. So there's a big, robust commodities and market in the physical money market for these TF2 items.
And
And
oh,
the
don't forget that Team Fortress, as you said, originally saw it as part of the Orange Box, and then they eventually made just strictly free to play, and now they make the majority of their money as you sell the hats, you can buy items, crates, all this essentially monetization stuff that's been added to what was once just a strictly retail game.
They play with the mystery box thing. Like you don't know what's in the crate. For all you know, it could be a special hat or a crate or a special hat with a crate. Who knows? But like that's the thing. Like you want to binge on those keys and just keep buying those crates. But eventually it piles up and you realize you lost $20. You're like, what a mistake! Like that's like three meals. But that's what happens. But I mean, but they're not. It's not a vicious system, right? It's obvious you can also make your money back through various other means to get stuff in your Steam wallet. And if you play a game, there's a mode that they added in TF2, also called MVM, which is a co-op mode where instead of just fighting other people, you fight against robots. And you have various waves and you defeat. And at the end, if you finish a whole rotation of maps, which is called a tour, you get the chance of having a rare drop. And some of those rare items are like gold items, and those gold items can sell for hundreds of dollars. Or you can get a pro kill streak kit, and that can sell for like 30, 40, or even hundreds of dollars themselves too. And I had a friend who just got a very basic, because first of all, there's three types of kits. There's a normal kill streak, specialized kill streak, and a pro's kill streak. And obviously, as you go up, the more you can sell it for. But she got a normal kill streak for an item that just got released for this update. And she sold for $150 because it was so rare. Bam, real dollars. And that's the crazy thing that people not only that people can put up items for that much money, but people will buy it for that much money.
And don't forget that mod makers can actually make items for Team Fortress, and if Valve likes it, they'll add it to the official rotation, then they will also receive a cut of anything that gets sold of it.
First 10 people that actually made items for TF2 in the workshop pretty much retired. From all the money they made, like the first week they made $80,000 or $100,000. It's crazy just for making
Yes.
a hat. So people make fun of hats. Hats are real money, all right? And
I'm in the wrong company, I think. I'm going the wrong way. I need to get in on this.
you sell some hats. But like if you unbox certain crates, you can also get an unusual hat, and they're like hats with particle effects attached to them. Make your head glow, have little things rotate around them, and they sell for hundreds of dollars too.
And just going back to what you said a minute ago, I mean, Valve is just so on the ball with how they've developed Team Fortress.
Because they're really putting their ear on like the community. Like not only do they have the pulse, they can feel what the community's doing, they can hear what the community's saying. but they also add it within all their updates, and they're really funny about it. And all those things within that movie that we talked about earlier, they had a lot of nods to community jokes, along with like jokes about how they can't count to three and a bunch of other stuff like that. And it's just beautiful. It's a lot of tongue in cheek amongst the community, and I think that's what makes them so successful. And now they added a bunch of taunts. I mean, there's taunts before, but now you can actually taunt opposing team members. Like, you can high-five opposing team members and stuff like that now after a match is over instead of killing them. And instead of now, before we had unusual hats, the really expensive hats you can find, really rare hats, now you have unusual taunts that you can find.
Which will, of course, be worth $50, $100 a piece at some point.
Probably tons of money. Hundreds of dollars, probably, right? At this moment in time, if you were to find one, they're probably worth like $500. Probably. So I'm thinking about throwing like $10 in my account, buying a bunch of keys, and hoping for the best. But I know what's going to happen. Realistically, what's going to happen is I'm going to get the same crappy item that's worth like 5 cents, and then I'm going to cry myself to sleep knowing that I wasted $10. I could use that in Steam sales.
Yeah, and I'll get, you know, a 5 cent item, basically.
I know. That's the luck. So that's how life is, though. You always hear these great stories like, I could do that. I could buy some Bitcoin. I could buy the I could get lottery tickets. And then you get to the party, you're like, well, it's over. Party's over. It's too late. Everyone's already heard about it. It's all gone.
Yeah,
that's the kind of thing. But TF2 is lucrative. Like, it's still alive because there's lots of support for it. And there's a lot of people still buying that stupid $100 ring. So there you go.
So what was added that's so surprising, like game-wise or game balance-wise?
Well, they added four items. One was a scout gun that if you shoot someone in the back, it does crit damage. They added a charge and targe, like a shield for the demo, which if you kill someone during a charge, you get a full recharge, so you can do it again. And then, but the items aren't really that big of a deal. There's a parachute that you can allow you to float as a soldier, so you can like shoot people from the air. I guess it's fun doing it, by the way. And there's one more item, but I think I forget what it is. Oh, it's a sniper item where you can charge without having a scope. But that's not the game changer. The game changer is those taunts. they added like 9 class specific taunts and like 5 to 6 like cooperative taunts, meaning things like not high five, but rock, paper, scissors, square dancing, do a flip, rock, paper, scissors, and conga line. Everyone conga lines now. So you can, you see someone doing a conga, you go behind them and you join in and you make a giant conga.
Nice.
And then people from the other team can also join the conga too. So like, it's just silliness. That's the big thing. It's silly dances and taunts. That's when you join a server, all you see is people doing these taunts and they're worth $10 a piece. The conga line's $10. The rest are $7.50. The class specifics are $5. You know what I mean? So they're making, and everyone has it. Think about how many people play TF2. The hundreds of thousands, million of people that play TF2, all buying one $10 taunt in one day. And not only that, buying all the taunts. And you can actually buy all the taunts for like $100 or something like that. And you can buy all the outfits for $250. So like, talking about whales and impulse buying, there's tons of it. I'm so pulled into buying that stuff. But at the same time, Steam sales. Oh, my wallet. So it's great to be right now. I feel sad for the console gamer because it's great being a PC gamer right now at this moment in time.
Yep. Okay. Is there anything else you want to mention about Team Fortress then?
Nope. Other than I have to really control my impulse.
And I really need to get in on this. I installed it last night, so maybe I'll play it some more. And I'll drop an item that's worth 5 cents, or maybe I'll get that $500 item eventually.
No, if you want to make money off TF2, play MBM, right? Play MBM, get good at it. And listen, my friend, after the second tour, $8 spent, they got a $150 item after two tours. And another friend made $1,000 through MBM.
Oh, come on.
So if you want to make some money, there you go.
All right. So with that, I have one last topic then we'll talk briefly about and we'll wrap things up. And this is one I know Ken's been dreading this whole time. And that is the latest Tropes versus Women video that was put out this week. So this one is the one that I think really showcases to me the problem that I had with not the points she makes, but how she presents them. So of course, for those of you who know, this is the latest Anita Sarkeesian video. This one is about the issue of using the trope of women essentially as objects or women are being just used as pure objects in video games. So, as either power-ups or an item that you can use. So, they're pretty much just interchangeable. And for the video, she brought up examples of how a lot of women featured in games as NPCs are usually seen as prostitutes or hookers, which the player can, of course, kill for bonuses and so on. So, the problem that I had with this video was some of the examples she used, she kind of just didn't frame it in any context. She just showed the main character attacking a woman and just leaving it at that. There's no mention of what was going on. And I think that the context in this case, it can sort of be used against her evidence. Like, for example, she showed the last Hitman game where he's inside a strip club and he's attacked. Like, she's showing him, you know, carrying around a dead hooker and putting it in a box. And, of course, it was meant to, you know, shock value. But she doesn't explain the fact that this is a level where the actual goal is to take out the guy who owns the strip club, who is, you know, generally an evil person. And I think this is where I have this problem that a lot of it feels like she's just falsifying evidence, or she's just showing evidence just to prove her point without putting it in the broader context. I think this is what you were talking about when we previously talked about her videos.
And the big thing is that she, watching the video, because I had you forced me to watch it, is that she framed it that all these, quote, mature games have strip clubs. She made it sound like all these things have strip clubs and this is a normal thing and the strippers in all the games, which is completely untrue.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the stuff that she showed is optional kind of stuff. I mean, and this is an area of debauchery. Like, you're going into a strip club, what do you expect to see?
Mm-hmm.
You're going into a brothel, what do you expect to see? But not every game has a brothel, but not every game has a strip club.
Mm-hmm.
But the examples that she used was purely like that. Like, there's so many games that don't use NPCs in this kind of manner. Mm-hmm. And a lot of current games don't use the game in this kind of manner. But again, she's just picking and choosing and without any context or any sort of references of what's happening in the story. I guess it's more, she's just trying to show that just them, by them being there, them existing,
mm-hmm.
is harmful. And I mean, she might have a point for that, but not in the context that she's explaining.
Exactly, and that's the problem. And I think this is one of the tough parts of when you're trying to discuss these videos, is that a lot of people associate her to the point she's making. So if you insult or you criticize one, you're seen as criticizing both. And I've had a few people who I've spoken to just had a conniption, basically, when I said that I had problems with her video.
Mm-hmm. I had a friend that did the same thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
She was like, it's feminism 101, get over it. I'm like, it's like, but I still watch her videos, I don't care. I'm like, all right, well, I don't like the way that she frames things. I don't like the context. I feel like she doesn't do enough research, and I feel like she's just putting her own, like, her own
agenda.
Ideas and agenda behind it and is picking and choosing and just reinforcing it, which is just bad writing and, you know, bad editing. You know, that's not fair. If you're trying to give a piece, then you need to give both sides, right? You can't just have it, like, just so heavily placed on one side. And just because there's been exploitation in the past doesn't mean that there aren't people working towards a better future. Look at the indie market.
Mm-hmm. And part of the issue is at some point she's just flat out lying. One example she was giving how shocking is when you kill a female character in Grand Theft Auto that the body disappears, and she's saying, oh, that's the psychological effect of making sure that you don't care about women. No, when any NPC you kill in a Grand Theft Auto game dies to basically free up the memory so the game doesn't crash because there's all these bodies laying around. And she made no mention of that in her argument.
Well, that's the problem, right? Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of the conventions, like, if you look at Miyamoto, he talks about how, like, he just makes the gameplay first and the narrative second.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that a lot of reason why these girls were, quote, objects or window dressing is because they're just kind of used to be to fill out an environment to make it feel like it's alive, per se. But not every environment is them being whored out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're just girls walking down the street. That's it. And that's it makes the city feel alive.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to be strippers. They don't have to be prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the example she picked was heavily just those things. But if a user didn't understand or play any games, like, or play, you know, excessively, they wouldn't know that. They just assume that every mature game out there is exploited to women, hurtful towards women. The women are seen as prostitutes or strippers.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's a question for you, Kenny. Is this something that a lot of people I was listening to debating about this? And that is, in open world games where you're given the freedom to do what you want, should you hold the developers accountable for not putting limits? So let me give you an example of that. And she showed the example from Red Dead Revolution, where there's an achievement for putting a woman on a railroad track and then the train hits her.
Redemption?
Yeah, I think so. Red Dead, the last one. I always get those two confused.
It's Red Dead Revolver and Red Dead Redemption.
Redemption, yeah, so that one. And she was talking about how these games like Grand Theft Auto, when you can run around and shoot women, you can shoot cops, whatever, she's saying, and what these people are saying, that because the developers don't limit that or put any restrictions on that, that they're endorsing or condoning those acts. While other people feel that the options are there because it is an open sandbox. You can do what you want and you're not being punished for it. So I'm just wondering, what do you think about that? Do you think that by having these options but not having any restrictions, that the developers are condoning, you know, shooting the women, shooting cops, whatever?
Wouldn't you think it's very unrealistic for you to shoot a person and then not have any effect? Isn't that the most jarring thing to take you out of a game?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't the point of a game, like if you're an open world game, you want to create a sense of immersion, right?
Mm-hmm.
But every time you put in vulnerable NPCs, it feels very unrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, the reason people go chaotic is just people get bored.
Yeah.
They don't want to follow the story. They just want to cause some havoc. And it's great. I mean, if they want to really stress that way, that's there. But it doesn't mean that they're mentally unstable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think a lot of people hated that you couldn't kill kids in Skyrim.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason that was placed in there because obviously people don't condone child killing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
But people modded it anyways. And now it's one of the most common mods. It's a child kill mod because they're annoying. You want them dead. It happens. And it's also hilarious to use a devastating finisher on a small child. Now, is that evil? Maybe in some regards.
Mm-hmm.
Is it humorous to some people? Yeah. And again, it's like, who are you punishing, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. punishing the developer's creativity. I think that's more messed up. And if they're really creating something immersive, you should be able to interact with everything.
Yeah. And that's, I think, where that line is very muddy between trying to decide if this was put in strictly as a mechanic or, you know, as fun, or do the developers, you know, hate women or they're trying to be sexist or misogynistic. And that's sort of where this real point of contention sort of lies. There was a piece on Eurogamer the other day about how a guy feels like this whole time he's really has been sexist because he's been enjoying these games.
Right.
And
wait, he was writing that he was sexist for liking these games?
That he felt that he was sexist without realizing it.
So, I mean, I don't go out of my way to go kill women or children when I play mm-hmm. these open world games. Everyone to me is, they're just NPCs in my mind anyways, so I just go and I just run through them. But again, not everyone. That's the point of open world games. Everyone plays them differently. The reason Skyrim is so beautiful is because everyone plays it differently in different regards, and that's what makes it so engaging. That's why it has the long shelf life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you know you can play it any way you want, and that's the beauty of it.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you take it away, then it's no better than those single player games when you're stuck in a stupid linear corridor,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. I think the problem for me is I can't really use myself as an example either for or against it, because I'm so used to looking at things critically that I don't see things as a story or see as, you know, how would I react in this? I see it as a series of challenges or events to accomplish, and that's it. So with that Red Dead Revolution, the achievement for putting the woman on the thing, I didn't do that because I didn't know it was there. If I did do it at that time, I don't think I would have felt disturbed or angry. I would just see it as, you know, check it off the list of things I could do in this world.
To me, yeah, and to me, I would reference it towards like the old like silent films, and that's the reason the developers were doing like a wink and a nod to it.
Mm-hmm.
There's already lots of violence in the games, but I guess it's just more jarring if it's violence against women, because again, that is very much a taboo thing. And I'm not saying it's okay,
mm-hmm.
but I'm saying there's more outcry for it. Than yeah. say killing a male character.
And that's what Anita's whole like foundation of her argument was in this video, was that while yes, you can kill the men, you can, you know, attack male characters as well, they're not the ones being sexualized in the game. So it's worse when you kill a female character than it is when you kill a male.
Well, it's just like this. It's like, it's okay to kill males. It's okay to sexualize males. Like, and the reason why, and a lot of people say it, and I talk to a lot of people about this, is they say
mm-hmm.
that it isn't the same because they haven't been objectified in the same kind of way. They're not mm-hmm. put in the same kind of context.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to keep that in mind when you're using that argument, because it's not mm-hmm. it's not a one-to-one argument,
yeah,
you know?
Definitely. And that's sort of where it gets really hard and muddy with the video game. So as you said, most times, female characters in video games are strictly used as background filler. The designer didn't have any grand intention other than they're just an NPC wandering around.
Mm-hmm.
But then this also raises the point that a lot of video games are developed strictly for the straight white male viewpoint. It's why these games have nothing but women strippers and women strip clubs, because that's what a straight white male want to go to. So there is definitely an issue that is going on that I think is being called out by the fact there are a lack of diverse characters in video games.
That's true. Well, and I think it's getting a little bit better
mm-hmm.
as the games go on, but the AAAs are not getting better.
Exactly.
They're still stuck where they are. But AA and indies are doing a great job in that field. There's so many games coming
mm-hmm.
out that speaks not just gender issues, but transgender issues, too.
Such as Going Home, which I think was a great example.
I love that game. But to me, the most sexist thing about me is I believe in, like any creativity. As your mind can think of it, you can create it. I don't want any sort of bounds on that kind of
mm-hmm.
stuff. I want to see everything, even if it is messed up or crazy
mm-hmm.
or misogynistic, whatever. I'm not saying perpetuate that stereotype. I'm saying you shouldn't put a limit on it.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with knowledge. That's why I'm,
mm-hmm.
all about freedom of information, freedom of knowledge. All that stuff should be open. And freedom, knowledge is meant to be free.
Yeah.
And I say as creative is meant to be free.
Mm-hmm.
But with open creativity, it's going to be racist, sexist, whatever. But
mm-hmm.
it can also be the opposite. It can also be beautiful and wonderful and
mm-hmm.
make like great points by using those themes against itself. And I think as soon as you start limiting and start doing censoring in like too heavily, that's when, we get into that state of the mundane and
the censorship.
Right. Like that's when like we start to lose our potential. And I think, and that's what I would hate
mm-hmm.
is to lose the potential of what could be because someone's kid might be offended or someone's kid might be affected. I'm like, screw that. Most of those games that they are complain about are mature games for kids above 18.
Mm-hmm.
So should it even like factor in? And if they want to do that, they should enforce it better. The end.
And as I said in previous casts, my viewpoint is that as a designer, you should be free to make whatever you want about whatever you want, and no one has the right to demand that you change this for whatever reason. But in the same breath, you're not immune to criticism. So if someone wants to make a game about rape or slavery or whatever, yes, they can do that, but then they also have to answer about why they had to make those games. On the other hand, as a consumer, you have the right to experience what you want. Someone makes a game that you don't like, you won't have to be forced to play it. But you can't demand that someone changes something because it offends you or a group. You cannot play it, you can convince people not to buy it, but to go down to that developer and say, I demand you change this, I don't think anyone has that authority.
Right, and I completely agree with that kind of thing. That's a pretty good mindset to
mm-hmm.
go under. And even though, like, example, like I said before, like being creative, if someone makes a sexy girl on a cover, I mean, it does do harm, yes. It does perpetuate
mm-hmm.
a stereotype, and that's bad. But I think as long as, people are aware, and, the guy's going to suffer most criticism, there's going to be, the market's going to speak against that, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's double-edged sword
yeah.
creativity.
Mm-hmm.
You're gonna get slot monsters, people that exploit everything
you're
under the sun,
like
from
BMX,
sex.
XXX, stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you're gonna get all those terrible things, but at the same time, you get such wondrous things at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I just want everything, whatever is there, or whatever creativity allows, to be open and free.
Yeah. And I would like to see more diverse characters. I have a post coming next week speaking about this. I'm tired of seeing every game have a straight white male protagonist.
With shaved head,
yeah.
military style.
Or, some stubble facial hair, big broad shoulders, that type of deal. It's kind of weird. This is another point that I don't have any, entitlement to these characters. I don't care if a character is black, white, Chinese, male, female, gay, straight. It doesn't bother me at all. But there's people out there, that this character, if I can't be myself in this game, it's horrible, I don't want to play it, and blah, blah, blah.
I think there's also fear, too,
mm-hmm.
that they misrepresent a race or a gender
mm-hmm.
because of that. They're like, well, sometimes people do have effort to try to make it sensitive enough to whatever race they are,
mm-hmm.
but then by doing it, they fulfill stereotypes, they make it even worse.
Yeah.
Or a game, like example, Remember Me had a black female protagonist,
mm-hmm.
and the game didn't do well, and actually, they didn't even want the character to be female because they said female characters don't sell,
mm-hmm.
and not only that, was she black, and it didn't sell well, but that wasn't really their fault, it was It wasn't the fault of the protagonist. It was the fault of the really bad combat system.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that, every time you have those kind of failings, it makes AAAs get farther and farther back from having a non-white male protagonist. That sucks.
Exactly. And that's what I'm going to say in the post next week, that I think the only way we're going to actually see a dramatic change is it's going to have to come from the indie sector.
Definitely, indies and double A's.
Because the AAA right now, they are focused on the 18 to 30 white or straight white male demographic. Because that's the tried and true. That's the one that's making them the most money. It's the easiest to sell to because you don't really need much. I mean, we talk about the whole military shooter craze. It doesn't take a lot to develop the next Call of Duty as opposed to someone trying to make the next Pikmin or the next Bioshock. Even though that was another first-person shooter, it had a lot more in terms of art style and thinking that went into it than your average shooter.
It's a game with a message, right? Just like we talk about movies being, oh, I'm empowered, I'm cool, it's a cool character. But these games can also have a message. Bioshock had that message. I mean, there was empowerment in it. Overall, there was still a point to the game.
Exactly.
A message to be heard.
Going back to the video, I think another poor example was like the whole when she brought up Deus Ex Human Revolution and she showed him killing a female hooker. But again, she doesn't fail to mention the fact that you can kill any character in the game regardless of race, gender, or age.
And they're in the slum and she's like a drug addict. I know which one she's talking about. She's like, hey, honey. I'm like, it makes sense. There's ultra poor out there. They're addicted to needing these drugs. So they do whatever they need to turn tricks. So that's the way any dystopic future is. It's not like and first of all, it's not a city of prostitutes. There are a ton of working women out there who look completely normal too.
Yeah.
But you have to go to a dark alley to find it. Yeah.
And you don't even have the option to have sex in Deus Ex. You can just talk to them. No. Well, of course, as we said, if someone completely unaware of Deus Ex watched that video, they would assume what we just said, that it's just about running around impaling prostitutes with spike arms.
It's like Mass Effect sex scene in Fox. They're like, oh my god, it's an alien sex simulator. It takes 40 hours to get that a point with lots of character building to get to the part when you have possible sex with one of the characters. But they don't mention that. Again, it's all context, right?
And that's the problem I have with these videos, that I agree with her points. The tropes that she mentions are valid issues within the game industry. But when she falsifies and doesn't show the evidence, it undermines her points, and then it makes it a lot easier for people just to discount them and discount her.
Right, and people, as I told my friend, and it's like, why don't you want to watch her videos? I'm like, well, because all that is, other people have the same message, but do it much better and much more fairly than she does.
Yeah. And I mean, just to be fair, I'll even throw out an example of what she's talking about. That's a real example, not something that was falsified, and that would be from Dragon's Crown. The shopkeeper in Dragon's Crown is basically a woman standing there, maybe a quarter dress. She's perfectly still except for her breasts animating up and down. And there's no in-game explanation for this other than pure titillation. They could have had, a male shopkeeper. They could have even just had an empty screen and it would serve the same function. And they just put this character in for sexualization's sake. And I think that would be a great example, which, of course, was not mentioned at all on the Tropes vs. Women video.
Right. I mean, they're just going for shock value. People that are half-informed and not informed at all.
The Fox News, essentially.
Yeah. Well, they're a different kind of uninformed. Yeah. But she's looking for, and plus, there is a lot of, games are still seen, even now, are seen more as, a guy's world kind of thing. Even though there's a lot more women going in the field, it still is kind of seen that way, and a lot of women kind of feel like they have to fight to be part of it. And I think, again, I think that has repercussions too, along with a lot of things she's trying to say.
Yep, exactly. And as I was saying, I want to see more women in the game industry. I want to see more diverse stories, but I don't think anything's going to change in the AAA market anytime soon. I'm being a bit pessimistic with that.
They're the slowest, that's why. They're the monoliths.
Yeah. And as we said, I think the big change is going to come from the indie market. Now, whether or not that's going to, rise up and affect AAA developers, that is somewhat debatable. I mean, even with, The Last of Us, they were arguing about having, her on the cover, I think, or having her as, a playable character.
I mean, she's a playable character.
But, they were afraid focus groups weren't going to like that.
That's what I hate focus groups about. All they do is ruin games. Ruin everything. It sucks. I don't care. An artist's vision is an artist's vision, right? That's what I believe. And when you do things because it might hurt someone's feelings, but it sacrifices your vision, then what is it anymore? It's a product, not your vision. I mean, it's a product purely for the consumer, not a product of your vision anymore.
Now, there is, of course, a debate that you're making a product for our pure titillation or sexualization, and that's what I think sort of what Anita is arguing. But as we said, a lot of her points, when you take in the context of the situation, they don't hold up to scrutiny. And I think that's what I think undermines her arguments. But I agree with what she's saying. I don't agree with how she's saying it.
Right. Like, again, my friend said feminism 101. And there's a lot of ways to get to the point that she's making. But again, the way that she's framing it, I feel like it's very dishonest to people that aren't aware. And that's what I dislike about it.
And I guess my final point then about this is I'm still not sure who her audience is. If she's trying to reach out to gamers, the guys and girls who know these games, they're going to see right through her and the lies she's saying. If she's trying to reach out to non-gamers and, you know, education-wise, there's a lot of false evidence here that would be, you know, found out very quickly. So I think she's hurting the broader argument by not making clear evidence. I mean, I think a lot of it is, I think she's just trying to fill these videos with as much evidence as she can possibly find to get, you know, maybe a certain time limit. Where if she kept to, you know, the straight evidence, it may be a shorter video that she may feel wouldn't be as impactful.
Well, maybe she's going for the uninformed feminist gamer.
Maybe. We don't know, unfortunately.
Well, I know one, so that's probably it.
So I think with that, this relatively short podcast got really long quick. So before we wrap things up, do you have any final thoughts about the video?
Well, there's a part two coming, so we'll see.
Yep. All right. Well, this was going to be a very short podcast, but again, things kind of got out of control, but I think we had some pretty good talks.
Dem movies. Yep. Movie conversation.
So with that, we're going to wrap things up. Ken, it was great talking to you. Hope your hands feel better, and hopefully your wallet will feel better this week. With
well,
Steam.
Maybe I'll sell some hats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as always, for those of you listening, if you would like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we are always looking for future guests and writers for pieces on the site. You can find the information for that under Submissions Wanted on the front page. And we are still working on our patron crowdfunding campaign to hopefully improve things on the site as well as do more live casting. You can find the information on that under the donate link on the front page as well. With that said, thank you for listening to the podcast this week. Hopefully you won't go broke with the Steam sale either, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.
Good night.